This is Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
Hello, everyone. This is Saqib welcoming you to another episode of Tennis with an Accent, brought to you in our collaboration with RadioInfluence.com. Today is a huge day for me because, you know, you all have listened to me talk about my tennis route starting from my days in New Delhi in India. And today's guest is a special guest. It's granted that everyone who comes to this show is out of my league, but this is like a personal favorite because I grew up reading a lot of Rohit Brijnath's work on tennis and cricket, and it's kind of a very surreal feeling to have him on the podcast today. Welcome, Rohit. So kind of you. I know you're not feeling well to join us from early morning in Singapore. Really appreciate this.
Hey, thanks for having me. You're already embarrassing me, but let's go.
No, it's not an embarrassment. I'll bring more of those memories as this conversation evolves. I know you are for us the generation who grew up reading Sports World, which was a weekly publication. You brought the likes of Becker and Graf and Lendl to our living rooms when India was embracing tennis, and we have very minimal coverage. But let's talk about what you are doing now. How close are you to the sport, and how many tennis tournaments you cover? If you do cover tennis at that level anymore?
Actually, I do very few. I go to the Australian Open every year, so I make sure I do at least one slam. And I particularly like going for the first slam of the year. I like it when the season opens. There's something very beautiful about it. And yeah, I'm a bit of a romantic, so I like the whole idea of, people, with new coaches and new dreams and, new everything and see what happens. So I do that. And then I do... now and then a couple of tournaments in Asia towards the end of the year, but more because the WTA Championships was held in Singapore. And so not very much, but obviously I watch and, I'm fascinated by great athletes, in turn by, people like Michael Jordan, Michael Phelps, Roger Federer. I am always interested in what makes exceptional players. I mean, it's obviously something we can't particularly answer because we can't really look in their heads. And I don't think exceptional athletes are always good at explaining what makes them exceptional. So it's a great journey to keep watching them and, finding little hints about what makes them great. And I like that. I really, really enjoyed the era of Federer. Let me put it that way.
So let me pick on something where he said exceptional athletes. So in tennis, I think for the last more than a decade, it has been an exceptional era. Along with Federer, there's been Nadal and Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray. So we've been quite privileged to see this kind of tennis royalty exist together. Before that, there was the John McEnroe and Pete Sampras, different eras. So, but this collection of four players in your covering of tennis, what do you think, and why do you think they stand out so much? Is the competition not as good, or they are just supremely above everyone else?
Yeah, I'm always wary of sort of rubbishing the competition because it's not fair. I think Stan Wawrinka might have a few things to say about that. But I think it's more that these guys are just, just standout players. I think I'm always impressed by their ability to keep a certain level through the year. And, I always find that interesting about athletes that, I'm sure, there are times that they're not in a good mood, you're not feeling too well, you're not timing the ball that well, but still they have this ability, this massive pride to keep picking themselves up, to keep playing at a certain level. Okay, but I want to just stop here for a moment. While they are fantastic to watch, and for me, obviously, Federer and Nadal, the from a writer's point of view, the contrast is obviously so important in personality and in style of play. But there's no question in my mind, if you ask me, I was really lucky. I had a boss in Calcutta who loved tennis. And so I went to my first Wimbledon in 1987 when I was, I think, 23. And I definitely preferred that era of tennis, if you ask me, just as theater. Because, in fact, I was just talking about it to Todd Woodbridge yesterday, who was in Singapore. And, I mean, I like serve and volley. And there was, you know, I think even the second level players are very interesting. Miroslav Mishir, you know, beautiful player. There was Leconte, there was Chang. There were so many different types of players. There was Tim Mayotte. And I liked the chipping and charging of it. And I think when I went, it was towards, I mean, Connors and McEnroe were still playing towards the end of their careers. So that was really fun. I remember going to see a McEnroe match. I can't remember which one of my early matches, you know, and the first point he goes to the net and drop volley, forehand drop volley, second point goes to the net, backhand drop volley. I mean, that is just, you know, that sort of stuff you're never going to see again. Oh, I hope maybe we will. But so I like that generation of tennis best because I found a whole range of players. Now, the baseline stuff sometimes gets on my nerves a little bit. I mean, what I admire is these people as athletes also. I think the modern players are great, great, great athletes. And I follow, because I go to the Olympic Games and Asian Games, and I follow other sports as well. So I can see how tennis players have grown as athletes, and it's quite impressive.
No, I think fully agree with you. This era, as talented and as disciplined they are, there's so much more information, so much more data, how to train, and every top player has, you know, multiple coaches, the way to train, the scheduling is, you know, such a, players are visionaries now to play longer, you know, they're playing less. And Federer is a pretty young 37-year-old, and Djokovic, who's going to be 32 soon, is not looking to slow down. He looks like he just restarted his dominance. So yeah, tennis has gotten older from the days you're talking about, because Wimbledon 87 is one of my early memories when Pat Cash won and Becker lost to Doohan. So let me just ask about you, since you covered those championships and even tennis in late 80s to early 90s, and I know everybody's talked about this at length, the racket chain, the string technology, the balls, but how hard was Becker and Cash? How hard were those guys playing compared to what you see today?
I mean, I just like that type of athleticism. As I said, these guys nowadays are terrific athletes. You know, their endurance and their speed is amazing. But those guys, I mean, you know, Becker was a big guy, you know, and used to get to the net pretty fast. A net play just brings a certain type of athleticism, which is really beautiful to watch, you know. You know, whether you're Edberg, you know, I loved Edberg. You know, I loved the way that he volleyed. I loved his fluidity. Didn't so much like his serve, but or his forehand. And but I love these guys in the net. I just like that. I think maybe because I grew up in India, and you know, Vijay Amritraj, and you know, all these guys used to serve in volley. And of course, in Calcutta, where I grew up, is a very famous club, which of course you know, called the South Club, which of course loved to boast that, you know, on some years it had better grass than Wimbledon. And so everybody there used to play serve and volley. I mean, everybody that I knew, you know, and the old-timers, Indian old-timers, Jaideep Mukherjee, Premjit Lal, there was Naresh Kumar, and all these guys, that's what they played. They played with these little slices and chips and dinks and drop volleys and stop volleys and half volleys. And I almost think that half of the vocabulary of the game doesn't even exist anymore. You know, it's just disappeared. And
yeah, it used to be called lawn tennis, right?
Yeah, and they played so many shots. You don't see so many of those shots anymore. You know, it's like, as I said, you know, it's like half the vocabulary of the game is gone. You know, you are only playing you know, you're standing in the baseline and hammering away occasionally, come to the net just maybe to finish a point occasionally. But I really liked Tsitsipas's defeat of Federer in Melbourne, because I felt that, you know, I think he put Federer off, in fact, by coming to the net, or just coming in, and he's got a big reach and not easy to lob. And I like that. Just made the game more fun to watch.
Hmm. So let's stay in that era for some more time. I know I said that especially we have a lot of Indian listeners here as well, or Indians who are living abroad, and they can relate to your writing days back in the time when we were consuming tennis through mainly Sports Star and Sports World magazines, and we had a handful of maybe 10 to 11 live matches a year till Prime Sports, the international cable company, started showing tennis. I think 91 US Open was the first one when we got our first major. So as a young writer who was also a tennis fan, that's why you got into it, and tennis was one of your first loves, like you mentioned. So did you feel like that was an era when tennis really transcended to a different audience level in India with the Becker-Graf days? And because I felt that as a fan, but again, as a young person, you think that's the world you live in and everybody else is following tennis. What was your memory and recollection of that time? Like, was tennis really taking off in India?
So I would say that obviously, you know, the like anywhere else, you know, the growth of media always makes a difference in, you know, the way news is transported to different places. I mean, in those days, you know, we had three sports magazines. You had Sports Week, you had Sports World, you had Sports Star, right? So, you know, there was a lot of information available on a weekly basis. Now, none of those magazines, of course, exist anymore. But I feel that even my father's generation, my father is really the one who introduced me to tennis. I'll always remember there used to be a small cupboard in my just next to the front door of my house where my father's sporting equipment used to be. And he used to have this wooden Schlesinger racket, and it was in a press. And I always used to wonder what it was. And I remember going to watch him play, and I'll never forget, he used to serve like they used to in the old days with one foot on the ground. It was quite elegant, actually, in a way. And so I think my father is the one who took me to Davis Cup for the first time. I remember watching John Alexander and Bob Guillotin in the South Club. And so I think tennis was big for him. I mean, he always told me, with no disrespect to Ramesh, he always used to tell me, no, Ramanathan is much greater than Ramesh. I said, okay, Dad, if you insist. So, which is probably true, actually, and right. But so there's, I think the national championships in India was still a big deal because Ramanathan was playing and all these guys I mentioned, Jaideep and Premjit, and, you know, who, I mean, Jaideep had got to the fourth round of Wimbledon, I think, four times, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, these were decent level players. And they played a lot of good doubles as well. And so I think there was definitely in India love for tennis because we'd been to, okay, now I hope I don't get my dates wrong. We'd been to the Davis Cup final in 66, was it? And then, of course, again in 74.
87.
And then again in 87. So, you know, we loved Davis Cup, you know, which is, of course, why Leander became a star in the early days initially. So I think Dennis was there. But yes, I think you're right that, you know, this Becker, I think Becker changed so many things for so many people. You know, he was just this incredibly charismatic character. I mean, I'm trying to think of generations after Becker. Maybe Agassi, who was maybe, okay, not as much loved in the early years, but he had his own charisma. But I think Becker definitely is the most charismatic figure that I can remember in tennis. And I was a bit lucky because I worked for Sports World magazine, which was part of the larger Ananda Bazaar Patrika group in Calcutta. And we had a great library and we had a great librarian. His name was Shakti Roy. Anybody from that era or from this era knows him because he was such a brilliant librarian is something that we don't speak about enough. So we used to get, you know, the New York Times on disc. And so he used to have all these discs, and then I would have to, because where do you get information from? Where do I know about Becker and who's coaching Becker and what did Becker say? And, you know, the newspapers had very little coverage. So you had to go through all the issues of New York Times, you know, one by one, looking for, you know, information because we were just dying for information. We just didn't have any, you know, just about, you know, just different characters that were involved in sports. So I have to thank the New York Times for a lot of the education that I got in tennis. I can't remember who used to write on tennis at that time. And then, of course, later I read a lot of Sports Illustrated. Curry Kirkpatrick, I think it was, who used to write on tennis. And, you know, now, of course, John Wertheim. But all these things are very important in my education because it was not easy to get. I mean, even tennis books, I'm trying to think if I even owned any tennis books. Well, the only one I can remember is by Rex Bellamy, the English writer, who was my great favorite.
It's, you know, it's so fitting that you're imparting this knowledge in a very formal platform. So we were taking, me and my friend Anand, who started this podcast with me a long time ago, and now it's produced by Radio Influence. But we were looking up to you weekly basis, you know, to know what the Becker-Ion-Tiriac relationship is, what Lendl is consuming for diet. And we were consuming through you, and you were consuming from New York Times and those archives. So it's such a fascinating, I mean, I find some closure. It's like very meaningful that you're sharing this here. I don't know if others going to enjoy this, but yeah, I mean, I used to listen to sports news in India at 7:05 p.m. in Hindi and 8:05 p.m. In English. It was a 5-minute capsule and they covered tennis, and I was just like such a geek. I never missed it for years. And it would be a difference between getting the news of Stockholm Open semi-final and the second semi-final. And that's how we were consuming tennis, and you were like such a mainstay. So let's take this conversation a little further by Becker. And I think you are absolutely right. Becker not only reached out to audience outside of Germany, because Tim Mayotte, who was here on the podcast a few months ago, said Becker in the late 80s and early 90s was as big as Michael Jordan was in the States. And none of the tennis players in America, since I've been living in America for the last 23 years, have been this big. I mean, US Open, if you go to Miami or Indian Well, looks like it's a tennis-crazed nation. But outside of that, tennis only works in certain pockets. And I don't think even American tennis players were as huge as in America, like what Federer and Nadal have become. So in one way, tennis has become very international. But the Becker example, really, I think you hit on something very important that some of today's generation, tennis fans don't know, like how big Becker and Graf were in, you know, transcending tennis to markets outside of, you know, your usual tennis nations.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really lucky. I mean, Graf, as you say, I mean, look, the in any sport, the present day is always more important than anywhere else. I just enjoy history. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I'm just going off on a little tangent here. One of the things I was chatting about with Todd Woodbridge yesterday was, I said, you know, somebody needs to do a book on that great generation of Australian players, you know, of Lever and Emerson and Sedgman and Rosewall, and, you know, they're all in their 80s. And I have some of their books. I have Lever's book and I have Rosewall's book, but I don't have any book on that era, which, you know, my father used to talk to me about, and whatever I've read. And, you know, I read Alan Trengrove's brilliant history of the Davis Cup. And, you know, these were astonishing. And it was just a different era. I read that book, A Handful of Summers, which is probably the best book I've ever read on tennis. And I think somebody needs to write a book before these guys disappear on that era, you know, because I think history is important. I'm a big reader, and I was just flicking through the book on Gottfried Ron Cram the other day, A Terrible Splendor, which is just brilliant. It's just one of the better tennis books that I've read. And so I think, you know, we shouldn't forget our history. I don't know if I've read a really good book on Becker, but I don't know. I can't remember, nothing off the top of my head or whatever. But we shouldn't forget our history, because history, you know, obviously gives the game a context and, you know, tells us where the game has come. And, you know, and it's, you know, various characters, of course.
So just staying with that era for one more question, and then we'll move further, because we don't want to waste too much. We don't want to spend too much on the 80s. I think I want to pick your brain throughout your coverage of majors. But going back to the Becker-Lendl era, how was the press room environment and how often you spoke to these guys? And part B of this question can be Ivan Lendl. Now he's known in modern era as like the coach who doesn't smile. He's making news with Murray. Now he's the mentor of Sasha Zverev. So what do you recall of your press room interactions with Ivan Lendl, and how much of a mystery he was to the press? Like, there was not much, you know, love coming out of the press for him back in the day. You know, I remember even SI Illustrated once even saying in an article, the champion who nobody cared about. So just walk us through your Becker and Lendl memories from the press rooms.
Okay, so I think that, you know, when I was just a 23-year-old from Calcutta at Wimbledon, I felt like a misfit. I felt out of place. You know, I almost felt like I didn't belong. And so I think we were I think it was the first time I'd ever gone out to cover any type of event. And obviously, I was in awe of these guys. I mean, I'm not in awe of them anymore, and I wasn't a long time ago. But at that time, I was in awe of them. And so there was no way that a guy from Sports World Calcutta is going to get like 5 minutes with Boris Becker. It was not happening. And but it was just fun to see them. I found Lendl actually quite funny. I found him very dry. You know, I found he had this dry humor, which I enjoyed. I thought that Sports Illustrated article was, in my opinion, terrible. I think it was a little bit of, you know, this East European player who, I think not all, but some journalists did not just understand. And so, I mean, he was an easy target. I mean, he wasn't the, you know, he was this stiff guy and he talked English in his own way. Why not? And so I thought he was an easy target. You know, he wasn't like Becker. Becker was more a different type of character. So was Edberg. But I can't tell you too much because I never got time to meet them one-on-one. And I have this story. I'm not going to mention whom. There was one of the top players at that time who I met on the staircase at Wimbledon. So I asked him, Emmett, any chance of an interview? And I was told to, well, F off. So that made me smile. So it was okay. I was, look, this happens to journalists all the time. It's not a big deal. But it was funny for a 20-something year old.
So did you cover other majors besides Wimbledon when you were a young man?
I went to two French Opens, which I actually, to be honest, fell in love with. I really enjoyed the French Open in those years. And in the years that I went, I'm trying to remember, 1991, who won there?
Gomez won 90.
Yeah, Jim Courier. You're right. Jim Courier. And of course, I saw Seles, who I really enjoyed. I'm a big Seles fan. Big. And I was lucky enough to meet her in Singapore and play with her for about 5 minutes. So that was like, you know, sort of boyish kick for a middle-aged man. Yeah. Bit pathetic, but still.
Did you chip and charge?
I did not dare. You probably drill a hole right through me even now. I love, you know, I thought she's, I mean, because of what happened and because Graf won so many slams, I think, you know, we just look at Seles in a different manner. But I thought she was the greatest player for me.
All right, so we'll talk a little more about Graf and Seles, but one more parting question on Lendl, because I remember from your writing days and my reading days back in India, and it's no secret, Lendl's obsession with Wimbledon. I think if there was actually a tennis god, he should have gotten lucky once. So what do you remember of that, you know, that period when he was just coming in second, he was losing semifinals to Becker and Edberg, lost two finals. Has there been like another case in tennis where one guy has chased a title so elusively and fallen short?
Maybe Sampras at the French Open, but
he never came close, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not to that level. He never came close. So I think he had one semi, that's it. And he had 1 year where he had a couple of good five-set wins, and then, you know, I think he was out of gas by the time he got to the semis. Yeah, I mean, but I'm just saying, I think he was chasing it in his head, but yes, he never got close enough. I'm trying to think. Bob, obviously, at the US Open, for sure.
Rohit, what I'm trying to say is even Roddick lost three Wimbledon finals, but I think Lendl's obsession, like when he was the best player in the world, he skipped French Open 2 years in a row. He came with a new racket, and everything he did just wasn't good enough. So I remember those days, and you know, your writing, so that's why I brought that up.
Yeah, but I love the story about Borg at the US Open when I think maybe was it the last one that he lost against Connors, the one where he just left the court. He just left the court and disappeared. But I think the funny thing was that, so I was obviously a great McEnroe fan because everybody was a fan because McEnroe was a rebel and, you know, we all wanted to be rebels. That's just the way it is, you know. Don't think everybody wants to be curious now. But the thing was, in those days, I had these long wristbands like Lendl. You know, he was used to wear these long wristbands. And I even bought myself Lendl's racket because in my mind, I thought, okay, maybe I can imitate Lendl because I cannot imitate McEnroe. And McEnroe was beyond that. I mean, he was it was like Merlin with a racket, you know, in a bad mood. And so, I mean, he was a different type of player. But I can remember, again, I'm 56, I can't remember this stuff. But I remember one semi-final at Wimbledon where Lendl was playing really well against Becker. And I think there was a rain break.
Yeah,
and
89.
When they came back,
two sets
and when they came
one,
back...
Yeah.
So I think that was, he was playing, I can remember him playing really well. And, you know, you have bad luck and that's what happens. But I think, you know, the sport deserves to have a certain amount of heartbreak. And I do believe that, I don't like this phrase, you know, X person deserves to win this. No, I think the only person who wins is the person who deserves it. You know, I think it's, you know, he tried. I admire Lendl for trying. You know, for having coaches who were good on grass by trying to learn how to volley. He was never a good volleyer, of course. And but he tried. I mean, it was, and I don't think he was ever, if my memory serves me right, shy about the fact that he really wanted to win Wimbledon. I mean, there was, I can't remember Borg saying too many things about the US Open, but I think that was the era when we didn't have enough information, so I don't know.
So that's, again, that kind of segues to my next topic, because you just mentioned Kyrgios. And, you know, in the McEndo day, he was a bad boy, Nastasi and Connors, and they said so many things. But like you said, there was very limited information. There weren't microphones. Everything that was said on court wasn't picked. So where do you stand on Nick Kyrgios? I'm not saying the guy is a saint. I mean, he's a young man who makes mistakes, and sometimes it's very easy to be on either, just, you know, he polarizes the discussion like no one has in tennis. You know, there's no middle ground with Nick. Where do you see him when you compare to the history of tennis that you've witnessed, and you think sometimes in this day of Twitter and social media, you know, we are too harsh on him, or he's getting what he, you know, what's coming his way, he deserves it?
Look, I mean, in a, as a general comment, I think, of course, there is a level of lunacy on social media, which is, I mean, I'm really glad I'm not 21 years old. Let me put it that way. Okay, I'm not a big fan of social media, even though I am on it. So I think people are incredibly cruel. Let me put it that way. And I really don't know what to think of Kyrgios anymore. I even met him once very briefly for maybe 5-6 minutes in Singapore for a short interview. And he was like, really, I don't give a shit. You know, that sort of attitude. I don't know. I can't understand him. Let me put it this way. You know, I think with most other athletes, you think we never understand athletes. We always think we do, but we never do completely. But with him, actually, I feel I have no understanding of him. I don't know what he wants, what has happened to him, why he's like this, why does he play tennis? Because does he like this game also? I mean, if he doesn't like it, why is he playing? Well, he's making money out of it or whatever. I don't know. I felt that I always feel, you know, not everybody in tennis can be Roger Federer, right? So you need guys who are a little bit off, so to speak, you know, who are going to do some odd things. And, you know, I have no issue with racket breaking to a point or whatever it is. But I think some of the tanking, problematic, not a big fan of. And of course, I think what he said to Wawrinka, I think put a lot of people off.
Yeah, I mean, that was exactly that.
Yeah, so that I feel that there's always a line that, you know, you do what you want, but, you know, don't do it with another player. So is it a bit sad? Yes, of course it's a bit sad, because he's a young man, you know, with talent. I don't want to, you know, I also feel people just go crazy about his talent. You know, oh man, he should be winning slams and this, that, the other. Not so easy to win slams. But talent, of course, you know, he can play lots of shots. You know, got a beautiful serve. Seems to be a decent athlete.
Let me ask you something recent. I don't know if you follow the results. He just beat Nadal a couple nights ago in a very very testy match. And, you know, Nadal was up 3 match points and then very unceremoniously or un-Nadal-like lost 5 points in a row. And then the Kyrgios celebration, the handshake was cold. And then they both took some jibes at each other in the press. So in that kind of scenario, you think Kyrgios, no respect. Again, no respect. Like, he's not disrespecting, but he's just... he's basically the same attitude-wise, the way he's going to behave against Federer or Nadal, or he's going to behave against, say, Malik Jaziri. And a lot of people believe that no respect attitude is the reason why he has won 6 out of those 10 matches against Nadal, Djokovic and Federer. So what's your take on that? I mean,
he's not scared and he's not in awe, but there's a difference between not being scared and not being in awe and being a jerk. So, I mean, though I found that handshake, that was a very strange handshake. I only saw it yesterday. But what I was interested in was the conversation, which I don't follow it too much because it gets tedious, but about the underhand serve. I have no issue with the underhand serve. I mean, if Nadal is going to stand that far back, I don't understand how an underhand serve is disrespectful. You know, this is a perfect... legitimate tactic, you know. But I saw that there was some, you know, debate over that.
Yeah, I think that's the point, Rohit. Let me add some context, because I watched the last two sets of the match, and you're right. Underhand was talked more on social media, and everybody had a GIF ready that this is what people should do. And even Federer was asked in press. But I think the contentious part was, there were a few times in the match when Kyrgios was ready to serve. He even once served an ace and Nadal wasn't ready. I think that's the part that got contentious, because Kyrgios in press said that in tennis you play at the server's pace, and a lot of times it's the other way around when you're playing Nadal. And Nadal said, you know, Nick is great, talent and everything, but he has zero respect for the game. So I think that was... So your thoughts on that. And then secondly, another... layer to this question is, sometimes we forget, like, when someone loses in a very tough battle, that's why sport is like such a live theater. And sometimes I'm sure players wish they hadn't said what they said after the match, because they're humans.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've got to... I was surprised by Nadal's comment, in the sense that Nadal doesn't usually say these sort of things. No, but he was pretty harsh on him, and maybe he deserved it. You know, I'm okay with that. I mean, I think, you know, he must have felt disrespected. He also lost, of course. But see, the thing is that this generation of players has produced an incredible standard of behavior. That I find very interesting, because I feel in modern sport, that's not always the case. Well, I think Federer has set a certain tone, and Nadal has been really good, and Djokovic, I think, has been wanting to follow that tone as well. So I think there's respect out there. Some say there's a little bit of fakery. I don't know. I don't care. As long as you're behaving, you know, in a decent manner, that's important to your sport. But at the same time, you've got to understand that these athletes are playing in a high-pressure environment. It gets a bit much. It is emotional. They are playing for, you know, you're playing for big prizes. So, I mean, there's going to be some, you know, people are going to have bad handshakes. As I always look at it like I'm interested in patterns. So, you know, guy has a spat on court, or he says something to umpire, or he breaks a racket or whatever. I'm cool with that. I mean, but if I see a pattern of behavior and I see the guy justifying everything he does, then I look at a player differently. But I think it happens once in a while. I think that's fine, because I think you're a human being. You know, this is what's going to happen. Let me put it this way. I always look at it that if I was 21 years old, or no, not even 21, if I was 20 years old and I had like microphones pushed into my face every day and everybody was taping what I was saying, I would talk a lot of nonsense, man, because I talked a lot of nonsense when I was 20. So, you know, it doesn't matter how much you tutor them or, you know, give them media training. There's still young people out there, you know. I mean, I like Tsitsipas, for example. He tweets all sorts of stuff. I think it's interesting. I don't judge him too harshly. My God, what does this mean? Oh, this is so stupid or whatever. It's just a young guy being himself. Yeah, let him just do what he wants.
And you know, this kind of is very interesting what you kind of mentioned there, because Ernest Gulbis, another big personality, big mouth of tennis, said a few years ago that the big mistake is because Federer, Nadal, Djokovic and Murray, they are all so boring because they are so PR bots. They're saying the same thing again and again. But again, like you said, we live the Becker and, you know, the other era where McEnroe and Becker were sometimes, you know, press conference were like an aftermatch extension, and there were comments being exchanged. So I think it's just an evolution. Maybe that time will come again if Nick Kyrgios and Sasha Zverev and some of these guys, Tsitsipas, if that's the successors, and they are, maybe it won't be all harmonious. But I think this the big three, you know, the classy act, and you know, I'm not saying this is bad. I think this is fine too. I think just like anything else, this has a place in itself.
Look, I mean, I think anybody who complains about Federer, I'm thinking, go watch something else, man. Because, I mean, I feel, of course, the way he plays is so utterly beautiful that, you know, because I didn't really think that somebody could play like that in this fast and powerful game, you know, play with that level of feel. And I think Federer in the press room, I don't find him boring. What I really like about Federer is that you can ask him anything. And I mean, he'll answer it. You can ask him about women's players. You can ask him about, you know, anything. I think he tends to answer most things that you put before him. And that's really what you want from a champion. Isn't that nice? And, you know, I don't find him surly or saying, I'm not answering that, or, you know, next question or stuff like that. So, I mean, I mean, Gulbis is Gulbis. So, I mean, let's not go there. So, I think you need a mix, no? We want a mix. We want guys like Federer and Nadal. Maybe one different kind of guys. And I think it's nice. I think because, again, as I said, I'm 56. I'm a little old-fashioned. I like respect for the game, which is giving you many things. I like respect for fans. I really feel our fans can be incredibly stupid at times, but I feel that must have respect for fans and for the game and institutions and history and stuff like that. Matters.
All right, so let's keep this little more historical as well. So obviously you've talked a lot about Becker, and you know, you've clearly stated how Federer is a delight to write about. What are some of the other players that you've enjoyed writing about over the years, and for what reasons?
Oh boy, what's the tough one?
Sellers? You mentioned Senes.
Yeah, Senes, of course. I still think the Senes Graf match that I watched in the French 8-6 in the third, was it?
Or 10-8,
I think. 10-8, okay, 10-8. I still think that's the best tennis match I've ever seen. And I think, I like to write about Senes because she played tennis in a very funny manner. And I, for good or bad, I'm a bit descriptive in my writing, so it's nice to write about somebody, you know, with double-handed on both sides, a little bit awkward in a way. Graf, of course. Oh man, this is a tough one, actually, trying to say who I like to write about. Who do I like to write about? Throw some names at me, man.
I mean, there have been a lot of players, like Sampras has been there, Agassi.
I love Sampras. I was a big Sampras fan. Big Sampras fan. Love that serve. Love that second serve. And I like volleying. And I think him against Agassi, when they played well, they had some really good matches. Nice, again, you know, what we want from sport, you know, and so there's contrast, different type of people. Everybody said he was deadly boring. Not for me. And I just found his game fascinating in itself. Who are the other guys in there?
Let me bring a current question. A lot of people, you know, say Federer Nadal rivalry because of all the contrasting reasons, lefty righty and whatnot is there. But I'm one of the few who argue that the Federer Djokovic rivalry is as up there, because those matches have been very competitive over the years. But I'm not a writer. I just consume tennis. So how do you break down the Federer-Djokovic rivalry from a prism of a writer?
Well, I think that's Federer-Djokovic is interesting because obviously there is some niggle there. I mean,
The niggle is old news now, right? I think they get along. But I'm just saying their matches have been very competitive. Yeah, you're right. Some of the niggle or some of the feistiness that was there post-2011 US Open, you know, was there for a few years. But I think overall, just from the tennis perspective, how do you see that matchup?
But I mean, I think eventually, hard for me to look at that beyond Nadal, because I just felt Federer was always trying to solve Nadal. And that's why for me, that 2017 Australian Open final was... which I was lucky to watch, was one of the most incredible things that I had seen. But I tell you, the rivalry that is my favorite is Borg and McEnroe, because it was only, I think, 7-7, 14 matches. And I think, in a way, this is going to sound almost absurd, is that maybe in a way these guys play each other too often. I love the fact that, you know, Djokovic Nadal is like 50-something matches. Yeah. And whereas I can almost remember... every match in, you know, Borg versus McEnroe, they were like big matches and big moments. So is it with these guys. But they were very few. I kind of like that. I sometimes almost think that you don't want to play too much. There has to be some level of anticipation. But they are like so good. They're playing each other almost every week or every 2 weeks,
I think,
every month.
I'm also with you a little bit because of, you know, I sit on the side of nostalgia myself. And growing up, Becker-Lendl was a rivalry I idolized the most, and those matches were very intense. But again, I think Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, their longevity at the top, I think, is also the reason why all these men have squared off more than like 35 to 40 times.
No question. The longevity has really pushed. I think the best match I've seen of these guys, or my favorite match, was a Rome final between Nadal and Federer, where I think Federer had a lot of match points, didn't convert. And those days, Rome was five sets. That, for me, is my favorite match, even more so than the Wimbledon final in 2008. Okay. Everything is a blur, man.
Sure. No, Roy, thanks for, chipping in for all these answers. I'm sure everybody who's going to tune in is going to enjoy it. So let's carry on. So I know you are also a tennis fan. So is there any change that you would like to see at the sport overall level? I mean, there's a lot going on. Like, Davis Cup has now a new identity and there's a shot clock in there. Is there anything else you would like to see, or where tennis stands? Are you okay with it right now, with the way the sport is?
I like the shot clock. I don't like the fact that the surfaces became homogenized. I don't like that at all. I mean, I much preferred Wimbledon when it was a greasy surface or a low bouncing surface. I think the surfaces are too even, which is why I think you can win on, you know, the all these four surfaces better, you know, I wouldn't say easier, but, you know, I think each surface is going to have a very, very, very specific challenge. I think some of that has been lost. I don't like that. I would plead with coaches to teach young players how to volley and come to the net. I can't understand how having an additional skill can hurt you. I don't understand it. Obviously, coaches know far more than I do. But it seems strange to me that so many of them just don't know how to volley. The Davis Cup, I feel, you know, it's a complicated thing, but I loved the Davis Cup and I loved home advantage. I love the idea of, you know, teams coming to your country to play. And I love that because I think it spread tennis and it brought players who you'd never otherwise see to your country, which is how basically you spread the game. And it made for all sorts of, you know, the whole legend of, Leander Paes. Leander Paes is, you know, such an awkward player with like so many flaws. He was incredible in the Davis Cup. I can't even describe it, what it was like in the early 90s in India, how he used to play Davis Cup. He was like a lunatic. I mean, it was so much fun to watch, you know. And are we never going to see anything like that again because we're all playing, you know, in one city or whatever. And too many cups going on. Other thing that really irritates me, I think I mentioned to you before, is this whole GOAT debate. That's the thing that irritates me the most, because I think that just using one number, how many Grand Slam titles you won to decide it, is just, I find it ridiculous, to be honest.
And do you think it's also somewhat belittling the players of the past, because this era is different than the previous eras?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Martina and Chris have said it so many times. They weren't counting slams. They were playing every tournament, you know. They were trying to build their tour. They were playing every tournament hard. I'm sure, you know, Rod Laver, you know, he left the tour and became a pro and missed so many Grand Slam titles. You know what? So we don't count those. I mean, it's just become this arbitrary thing. I don't know. I don't even think in the Becker era anybody was counting, you know. And you have to look at so many things when you're looking at a great player, you know, and it cannot be just one number. Oh, he's got 20, he's got 17. If he overtakes him, he's the greatest player. I mean, seems like a very one-eyed, one-dimensional view of greatness. I think you've got to look at all the services, you've got to look at the head-to-head, you've got to look at, I mean, look at Federer's, you know, consistency at the slams, you know, how many semifinals in a row, how many quarterfinals in a row, all those things, do they not matter? Do the Masters not matter? How can it be? I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I think this is again, no matter what side of the fence you sit on, this has become a very different conversation in tennis, in the tennis Twitter and tennis world.
And I'll tell you another thing. Sorry, I'll just interrupt you, Sakir. I'm sorry. Is that I don't like the fact that, you know, the only thing about the Federer-Nadal rivalry that I've not liked is one set of fans diminishing the rival player to, you know, push up their own player. So, you know, Nadal fans will diminish Federer and Federer fans will diminish Nadal. And I'm thinking, these two players don't diminish each other. Why are we behaving in this manner and, you know, and are not able to enjoy them both? And eventually in the end, the key about sport is you will like a particular player because of what he means to you. It has nothing to do eventually with how many slams he wins. Your favorite is because that guy has a certain music in his game or something about him which appeals to you. That's it. You know, it doesn't matter for me how many slams Djokovic wins. Federer appeals to me in a particular way, right? And same way for a Djokovic fan, even though he's not even won as many titles as Federer yet, there's something that Djokovic does for that person. That's it. Now, what does this player do for me in any sport? And that's all that matters.
I think exactly. We can talk about it endless, but the flip side of the social media and this direct interaction between different fandoms is this, because it gets personal and sometimes they start owning the player while the players all get along, you know, and we all are guilty of, you know, taking one player's side. But then the advantage is, you know, for a nobody like me, you know, I get to connect with people like you, Carl Bialik, Mark Woodford, Jonas Bjorkman. So, you know, we live in this world where social media has many advantages, and I think this tennis fandom war is sometimes gets a little old, but it's also fun. But I see what you're saying. You know, it's a combination of a lot of things. So let me ask you one thing. I know before the show we started recording, you said you're not close to the Indian tennis scene, but as someone who's a tennis fan growing from India, the serve and volley days, are you surprised that, you know, the year is 2019 and India still hasn't produced a top 50 singles player?
So I think what's interesting about India is that we are seeing so many different types of athletes that we didn't see before. The Asian Games, a lot of track and field athletes did well, even though you did have P.T. Usha in the old days. You know, there are badminton players, there are rowers, I think, who did well. There are all sorts of athletes. So that is quite fascinating for me, because I grew up in a time when, you know, we had cricket. And of course, a little bit of Leander and V. Anand, the chess player, and, you know, and I mean, you know, women boxers, Mary Kom nowadays. I mean, it's fantastic. It's nice to watch. So maybe from somewhere, a tennis player is going to emerge.
So you think, I heard a long time ago on TV, I think McEnroe brothers said something that after Roddick, we haven't had tennis players, and those are the days when they were talking a lot what happened to American greatness. And they said part of the problem is tennis is a second-tier sport. The top talent goes to hockey, basketball, baseball, and football. So maybe similarly in India, the top talent goes to cricket, and then even Indian soccer, which may not be prominent at the world level, it's a huge following in India. So maybe some of the young kids are just going in other sports, because I don't see many Indians coming out, because I've been going to tournaments and even the junior ranks. There's just and then there's this inclination to play more doubles. There's nothing wrong with doubles, but we haven't really seen the singles player. Yuki Bambri is there, but he's been perennially injured, and Ramkumar Ramanathan seems like the best guy to come out of the system for some time.
Yeah, I'm not sure I completely agree with you about the best talent going to cricket, but yes, I mean, obviously everybody wants to do well in cricket because that's where the fame is and that's where the money is. And of course, even if you play one season of 2020, you know, you can make a great deal of money. You can change your family's life. And that's, in a way, it's quite a wonderful thing. I quite like that. But I think that there's a sizable population in India. So I think there are enough people to go to many different sports. So it depends. I mean, so I said, I'm speaking out of a little bit of ignorance here. I mean, I don't know how many tennis setups there are in India, how many coaches there are, how many physios there are, what's the level of training to make somebody into a great athlete. I mean, those are the things that you really need. And of course, you need lots of numbers. And so I have no idea what's happening at that level, you know, whether we have a... We're trying to put a production line into place, a sort of factory, and it's happening. I don't see it, but I wouldn't know for sure.
Okay, Lloyd, so let's conclude this podcast and talk about, you know, how I, you know, got introduced to you with your writing. So what do you think has gone different in the world of sports writing today? Because there's a very different way of, you know, these articles being fed to the audience, and their blogs, of course, there's quality writing, but... overall, writing space has become small. A lot of clickbait, buzzwords. Sometimes there are publications who are just using, deceptive headlines, using a comment from Nadal or Nadal's uncle, vice versa, from long time ago. And when you read the article, there's nothing there. And then there's an old school writing like yourself, who have been doing, you know, or Steve Flink is still writing about tennis. Louisa Thomas writes for the New Yorker. So there's still a lot of quality writers. But overall, where do you stand with the way the writing is going in the sport?
Yeah, I mean, let's blame editors. But I'm lucky. I have a boss who pretty much lets me write how I want, which some people like and some people don't, which is fine. But I think there's some good writers out there who I enjoy. I mean, I think Louisa Thomas is special. I love the way she writes, and could read her any day at any time. I like John Wertheim a lot. I think his mailbag is one of the best things in tennis. I think he's such an even person. I think he argues subjects very well and evenly. I like that. I like Courtney Nguyen, who works for the WTA, who really works incredibly hard to get us stories about women athletes and women tennis players, which I think is incredibly important. I have a daughter. I even had a granddaughter. So I'm very interested in stories about women athletes. And yeah, but I think, you know, Rex Bellamy, who I mentioned earlier, this was to work for the Times London, I think. I'm not sure. I think so. So write so beautifully. I mean, I don't know if newspapers will allow that now. They want scoops, or they want, you know, the news, hard news and analysis. And sometimes, but sport is a very beautiful thing, you know, and we should capture that. We should not let it go. You know, the characters and the places and the history. And I still didn't think there's, you know, obviously place for long form journalism. You know, I occasionally read, what's a, okay, this is my memory suffering here. What is an, Brian Phillips, you know, Brian Phillips writes just, I mean, so, I'm in all of these guys.
So let me ask you a different question then, because back in the day, and you know, the writers you mentioned, people talk about a match and what happened in a match, and you know, that's what the sport is. Of course, we should talk about, you know, something that's controversial, or something that player A or B did wrong, or something that the authorities are not doing, or maybe the activist part of sport. We should also follow those narratives. But I find like there's a great divide. There's certain writing styles that'll just find, you know, these kind of investigative stories in sport, and then there are very few people who are actually writing about the game itself, how the match was. Looks like a lot of those, again, no names, but a lot of writers have just checked out. They don't want to talk about the match. They'll talk about maybe if an umpire came down and helped Kyrgios. They want to talk about the X factor, you know, that's taking away from the tennis. Do you feel the same way? Do you think there's like a great divide in terms of reporting?
I think that basically, I find there's a lot of reliance on quotes, which sometimes can be, for me, a bit dull, because athletes don't always have something entertaining to say. And I think writers should put themselves out there, you know, and try different things and write in different ways. And but as I said, it depends. I mean, I don't know whether editors allow you to do some of the things, and everybody's looking at how many page views you've got. And so maybe you have to do the type of stories which get you page views, not necessarily the type of stories that you want to do or you think people want to read.
Sure.
So it's complicated. But I think, look, they are very talented writers out there. I mean, you know, in the press box. And, you know, I tell you, one of the sad things for me is that, of course, that you can't read. I can't read in. I can only read tennis that is written in English. You know, I wonder, you know, what French writers are writing, what Spanish writers are writing, all that sort of stuff, which I'm sure is quite fascinating. So that I don't know. So
no, on that note, if you ever have a chance, check out our site, Tennis with an Accent, and our own Matt Zemek, who I partner with on this podcast on the website. He's, I think, a very old school, and you know, he writes quality articles. Again, I'm kind of a biased voice because I've partnered with him, but check his work out.
And I like Steve Tignor.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's definitely one of them.
I feel a little bit in awe of them, because I think these guys are all different levels of writers. Tignor, of course, I think knows the game 100 times better than I do. Brian Phillips and Louisa Thomas, I mean, their command over the language is phenomenal. So for me, it's great. I mean, in a way, to read these people is like an education. Yeah. So that's very nice.
So last question. So what is an advice Rohit Brijnath will give to any young tennis writer who's going on to these tournaments? How to go about picking a match, or what should he write about? Should he just focus on a big story and the main court, or should he just capture the match of the day? What are some of your tips, if you want to impart, as we conclude this podcast, to any budding writers who are going to these tournaments?
So one of the things I always like about sport is I always think young writers should go and watch practice. I think you learn a lot of things in practice. You know, just about players. I mean, I've always liked to watch athletes in all sports when they're practicing, because nobody goes to watch them practice. You know, and you actually see athletes hit shots which you'll never see on the court because they do amazing stuff in practice. And I think I understand athletes better in practice on how much they're willing to give to be great. So that's one thing which is never, for me, comes across strongly enough. I don't think people often go and watch practice is different at a Grand Slam event. So then going to somebody's base and watching. What would I want to read? I like small details. I like writers who capture small details. All sorts of things. I want to know that the writer is there at that event. And then I want to know things that I can't see on television. So television is showing me one thing. The camera is showing me one thing. But there are so many other things happening which I think need to be caught. At least that's what I tell my younger writers. I said, if I'm going to send you to an event, then you need to tell me something that I can't see, you know, maybe just away from the court, or the camera's on one player and what's happening somewhere else. And just little sketches, you know. I think a match report should be full of little sketches. That's what I would like to read.
I know that was very valuable, and I'm sure anyone who's from my background and my generation, you know, growing up in India, will definitely enjoy this. But I think you gave plenty for any tennis fan in this podcast. I'm so grateful you came here. I enjoyed this, and hopefully we can do this again sometime. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I hope I've said something vaguely sensible. That's all.
On this week's episode of Crush Performance, as promised, I go over the incredible numbers from the 2018 MLB season to show us just how baseball is changing right before our eyes. And we ask the question, is the NFL Combine the toughest player evaluation in all of sport? And we also look at player health and injury prevention. It's a top priority in all of sport. We talk to Dr. Teo Bristig of TopSpin 360, the recipients of the NFL's 2019 First and Future Safety Innovation Award, about this incredible piece of equipment and how it's helping us keep players safe. Crush Performance, your weekly source for sport performance and athletic development information. If you're a serious athlete, a weekend warrior, parent, or coach, join us each week as we investigate the latest trends and research coming out of the sport performance world. We'll visit with top athletes, coaches, and sports scientists to keep you on the cutting edge and to find out what it truly takes to achieve human maximum performance. You can visit us online at crushperformance.com, and Crush Performance Radio with me, Jeff Kershaw, can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and at Radio Influence.